You're listening to the ISF Podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve speaks with Karina Mann, whose expertise is connecting organizations with leaders in technology as a senior client partner at Korn Ferry. Karina highlights the growing awareness of cyber by boards of directors, an awareness brought on by the increase in cyber intrusions. She emphasizes the importance of storytelling and collaboration, and she and Steve discuss AI and the preparedness of the board.
Karina, hello. Lovely to see you. Thanks very much for joining me on the podcast today.
Steve, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Now, cyber and the board, big topic. They've been made more complicated, I would say, by AI making a sudden appearance in the boardroom too and pulling up something of an empty chair. And that's what we're going to talk about. So cyber today is not just about IT anymore. It's nothing really technical, I would say. We've moved away from some of those old silos that used to exist. But have boards really grasped that yet? Or what's your insight? What's your view?
That's a great question. And it's the big question. And so I would say that boards are actually more cyber savvy than ever before, largely because they can't get away from the topic. And too many of them have had, unfortunately, firsthand experience, usually post-incidents, right? Or in the middle of an incident when they do get called in. And I would say that their awareness of the threats to the enterprise, threats to the organization, are greater than ever. At the same time, like you said, with the rise of AI, even the threat landscape has changed. It's no longer just cyber criminals, it's state actors, there's deep fakes, there's just so many vectors of attack that I think that there is a little bit of confusion. And I would even dare say one board member provocatively said, if we're going to be attacked, why do we even have cybersecurity? Why don't we just pay the ransom when we get attacked? And it was not meant to be taken literally, but one to be provocative to say, if this is going to happen with such great frequency, what can we really do about this?
I like that. I think you're absolutely right. My own experience of boards, I've been working down at Henley Business School for about the last 8 years or so now on their board program. And the way in which the boards coming through that have matured over that period of time is really quite staggering. But that sort of provocative question, that I love that. I think that's exactly what boards need to be doing, because all too often, that historically they sort of deferred to Susan or Fred or whoever it is who gets IT, let's listen to what they've got to say and then we'll take it from there. And the issue around, ransomware, as you mentioned it, is one that I think we probably need to be having more discussions about. We're starting to see regulation preventing some of the payment of ransomware in certain places. We all know that it still takes place. People will pay rather than anything else. Just sticking with that area for one moment, what sort of advice do you give to boards when they ask a provocative question like that? But actually, underneath it, it's a very serious question that they're trying to come up with an answer to.
Yeah, there's a follow-up question to that. Let's uncover that. What's the real concern under that? If we go back to what boards are really charged with, they're charged with oversight and governance. They are there to really provide guardrails, in many ways, allow the organization to go fast by asking the right questions. And also, they're the CEO's boss, right? And so they are there to provide that oversight. So if you peel back one more layer on that question, we're going to just keep being attacked. Why do we keep spending all this money on cyber security and InfoSec? Why don't we just pay the ransomware? The question under that is, are we then deploying our resources in the right way? These cybersecurity budgets are going up every year. And I would also say that in the last couple of years, particularly since lockdown, since the pandemic, when everyone went home, worked from home or worked remotely, there was a bit of a proliferation of cybersecurity tools. And CEOs, CFOs, and of course the board are asking these questions. It's like, wait a minute, every year our budgets go up, CISOs keep continuing to ask for headcount. And yet when our CISOs, when Fred, when Susan comes and they present to us quarterly or they present to us annually, the first thing we see is a slide that shows all the scary statistics, right? This many attempted intrusions, this many incidents, et cetera, this many things thwarted, these many attempts. And so when they see this, they kind of tend to throw up their hands and say, again, I'm not really seeing the value of cybersecurity prevention or our program in general. And so I think when boards ask those provocative questions, what they're really doing is challenging either the CIO or the CISO to really come forward and articulate, what's the story here, right? What are we doing? Why are we investing in this? And is this truly a strategic area, as our CISOs claim, or they say that it is, when it's really hard to quantify the value of it?
I think that's absolutely right. What are some of the ways that you've seen that the CIOs or CISOs can really crack that nut? Because it's hugely important, right?
That's right. Let's also remember that the role of the CISO is really just a little over a decade old.
Right.
If I may invoke the attack on Target, which was like the seminal thing that really brought cybersecurity to the forefront beyond just the boardroom, beyond just the enterprise. Consumers in North America were affected deeply by it. So it became something that a lot of people became aware of. But the role itself is really only about a decade old.
Right.
And in that decade, we've expected CISOs and InfoSec professionals to really come from being an operational, back office, defensive organization to being at the forefront, being able to interface with the CFO, right, and the CEO, to be able to come to the boardrooms. At the same time, talk to the marketing folks about what's important. Talk to the product development people about how you need to incorporate security awareness into your products. So I would say that there's also been this compressed timeline in terms of requiring the CISO to come forward and be able to tell the story. But this is where I would focus on, is to be able to tell the story. And so in the work that I do at Korn Ferry, when I am also assessing and helping my clients hire their next CISO, one of the things I'm looking for is not just someone who's technically deep, but someone who has the empathy, someone who really understands what it is that the business is trying to do. So if it is a software company, at some point, the product and feature set are going to be comparable, right? The prices are going to be comparable. But if a cybersecurity expert, a CISO, can help the salespeople go out into the field and really differentiate the product and say, you're right, there's a lot of indifferentiation. But what differentiates us is that we stand by it, right? Maybe we drink our own champagne, right? We use this system when we are interfacing with our clients or customers, or we have built this type of cybersecurity into the product. Then at that point, the CISO just also becomes a sales enablement person. That's one of the differences. If it's a consumer product, for example, again, who is your end customer? Your end customer are everyday people who don't want their data on the dark web, who don't want their interactions with your brand, who don't want their preferences to be available to everyone. So think about how do we, for our CPG company, right? How do we enable our customers to have great experiences? How do we enable our product and marketing folks to delight these customers and keep them safe? That's the story that CISOs rarely tell, I would say. They're getting better at it, but I would say very few CISOs tell that story. And they tend to focus on, again, the scary page of statistics in terms of how to keep the enterprise safe. Take it down one level. Take it down to the customer level.
I think that's really good advice. It's very interesting, actually, that you point out that the CISO role's only been around for about 10 years, because I think there is a tendency to forget that. We think that it's been around for very, very much longer. But as it develops, there has certainly been this shift away from it being purely technically focused, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Let's put a whole pile of statistics, moving much more towards what I see in certainly some of the top tier CISOs as people who, to your point, do have the ability to use empathy, do have the ability to align what they're doing with the business. But I would also say that those kinds of individuals are still very few and far between. My next question to you is, how can people migrate along that career path? How can they identify, I suppose, some of these, what I would term real role models? And what are some of the steps that they can take to develop themselves into the sorts of CISOs that we've just been talking about?
That's a great question. And I also think about what some of the top CIO and top CTOs have done, because again, along those lines, 25, 30 years ago, the CIO role was relatively new and they were suddenly elevated from, these were the folks who were working on my mainframe, right? Especially with digitization, the first wave of internet 1.0, right? They really had to step up. But a lot of them, they didn't have the training courses. There was no mentorship. A lot of them just had to go and do it. And it was through trial and error. Mm. And so I would say CISOs, for those who are much more comfortable with policy memos, right, or much more comfortable communicating through others, challenge yourself to go step out and communicate, you know, have those one-on-one meetings outside of the IT group, right? Outside of the cybersecurity group, sit down with the marketing folks, sit down with the chief legal officer, sit down with the chief risk officer, ask those questions. And then rather than say, come here and let me explain, understand what it is that they are trying to accomplish. Understand what it is that keeps them up at night. It could be that a conversation around unstructured data with your chief marketing officer leads to a much deeper relationship because there's this understanding of, okay, I understand, I empathize with what you're trying to do, how you're trying to add value to our company or create value for our company. How can I step in, right? How can I do that? So number one is just go have those conversations. They're not going to be perfect at first, but building those relationships is really important. And I always say, whenever you join an organization, you're hired for all of your experiences and all your expertise, but on your first day at the company, your trust jar is empty, right? You have to go and fill that trust jar. And so go and build those relationships and continue to fill that trust jar. The second thing I would also say is, again, with our conversation here, it's about that board interaction. And it's really understanding that the story or what the information that the board needs to hear from you, the CISO, is not the operational details that you would normally report out. I would encourage CISOs to go and join a nonprofit board, for example, something that you're really passionate about, an organization in your community, an organization in your field. It could be your kid's school, but join in a nonprofit board. See what it's like to sit as a board member, digest this information and hear what's important. You'll have a really good sense for the kind of responsibilities that fall upon a board member. And then take that experience, right? And turn around. It's like, okay, now I'm going to shift my identity from being, you know, an operator, someone who's here to defend the company. Let me turn this around. I've got 15 to 30 minutes to either impress upon or to share the story of why this is important. Again, from an oversight and governance angle. Always think of that oversight and governance. So these are the people who are the fiduciaries who have the duty of care and must be responsible for overseeing all of the governance for the company. I would always encourage sitting in a board, and doesn't have to be a corporate board, a nonprofit board can really change your sense of perspective and your identity.
I would agree with that. Putting yourself in the other person's shoes is always a good place to start. And I'm glad you mentioned the chief legal officer, because increasingly, of course, CISOs are having to deal with regulation, particularly those that are running multinational security organizations, because regulation continues to be this patchwork quilt of different things that emerge and happen on an ongoing basis. And the chief legal counsel very often can provide some of that insight or advice as to which side of the line the CISO needs to be walking. So that's another one not to forget.
And to add to that point, Steve, you know, on the chief legal officer side, the conversation there, it usually starts from a place of compliance, right? It usually starts with a patchwork of requirements, particularly for global multinational companies. But from there, the conversation can evolve beyond compliance. What can we do in terms of training our workforce or making people more aware? You know, what can we also do to get one step ahead? We see in certain industries, for example, government affairs, corporate affairs has become a very important. The geopolitical situation has also required many CEOs and other executives to step outside of the corporate boardroom and the C-suites and go into these capitals, whether they're European capitals, Asian capitals, North American capitals, but really to have those conversations with political leaders. I would also say that initial conversation with the chief legal officer could end up becoming and evolving into a much more complex and rich conversation around how to protect the company.
No, I would agree with that. And we've spent a little bit of time now talking about the sort of upper end of the organization, if you like, the board. One of the other challenges, certainly, I think that CISOs are constantly having to face, of course, is the opposite end of the spectrum, if you like, which is the end user. And balancing the needs of the two ends, I think, is something that they always need to be very aware of. And you mentioned compliance there. Compliance for me is very often used, I would say, as some of an excuse rather than anything else. I'm not a big compliance fan, mainly because good compliance doesn't always make for good security. And I believe the opposite is true. But I was with somebody this morning, a healthcare provider, frontline healthcare provider, who was telling me that he has to change his password across all different systems every 2 weeks, and no password can be the same. And when he makes the change, it can't be similar. So it can't be something like, I don't know, edition 123, and then change it to edition 1234. It has to be completely different. And I said to him, well, how do you cope with that? I said, because you can't possibly remember it. Thinking he was going to say, well, it's not a problem because we've got this password manager that we use. He said, I write them down. because that's the only way I can remember it. And that for me was a good example of how security had moved probably too far, had forgotten the end user. You know, yes, we're compliant, we're changing passwords every fortnight, but our users are writing them all down and off you go. You know, we're a small sort of hop, skip and a jump from the old post-it note stuck on the laptop to get access to it. I think the CISO remembering that there are all sorts of level that they have to be working with, and the board also remembering that it isn't just strategy that they're dealing with. It's governance from the top to the bottom, even down to some of these, what some might consider to be very trivial issues around passwords. But the board understanding that overall responsibility that it has. And I'm interested in your view here, because boards have no issue at all understanding fiduciary responsibility. It's in the DNA, right? It's there. Do you think they fully understand the overall scope of their cyber responsibilities?
That's a really great question. And you're absolutely right. We all get, I know I do, I get an email message every couple of weeks saying that, you know, it's like, oh, this company that I use, it's been compromised, or my passwords have been compromised. Please, please change your passwords. And, you know, the board, there's also a tendency to get inured. Mm-hmm. It's hard to really find that sense of urgency when everything is an emergency. We just get used to operating at that level. But to your question, I would say that what boards also need to think about is beyond just the fiduciary, is also, you know, what we started with. The company is going to experience an incident. They're going to experience attempted intrusions. And one of the things that we wrote about in a paper recently is turn the page on the attack and focus on resilience. It's going to happen. How prepared are we as a company, all the way down, like you said, down to the consumer level, to really bounce back from this, to respond to this? I think in the last couple of years, we've seen some really severe, hurtful attacks where employees couldn't even badge in to the systems because companies, they weren't able to say with certainty how deeply compromised their systems were or how deeply into the systems the bad actors had gotten. So even things like badging in would have given another point of entry to the bad guys. And so they had to lock out their employees, or they were issuing things on pencil and paper because they just couldn't get onto their systems. And so these are the sort of things that boards also have to remember, is that when there is an incident, it's also understanding, what does this mean for us? One question could be like, in a worst case scenario, how long would it take to reboot the company, to get all of our processes started again, to get our workflows going again, to get production lines back up and running safely? We saw CPG companies that were attacked that could not get product out to the shelves. They couldn't manufacture them. You know, the supply chains were compromised. They couldn't get product out to the shelves. And so that's the question that boards should also be able to jump in and ask, is it's not just tell me about the attack, but it's also what's the next layer? The next layer is, what are the biggest priorities? Are the priorities to, one, make sure our customers are safe, make sure our employees are safe? Have we contained this, right? Is it quarantined? Can we continue to work? One of the things when I talk to CISOs is that they say, yes, we know that this state actor is in our systems, but we've got them isolated and quarantined, and we're able to use a fail-safe system, or those particular systems were air-gapped. Our production lines, all of our manufacturing plants were air-gapped. And while the corporate systems might have been compromised or impacted, we can still continue to make product. So these are the sort of stories or the sort of understanding that CISO should help share, you know, to help impress upon the board members, these audit committee members, risk committee members. This is what they should understand, is that these are the steps that have been taken.
No, I think that's really good advice. And certainly, I'm seeing a lot more boards becoming actively involved in running cyber simulation exercises, tabletops, that kind of thing, to try and understand how it might all impact and what they should do. And just getting, again, that reassurance, as you've rightly pointed out, that the organization is sufficiently resilient, that everybody understands how long the systems can be down for, and there are the backups in place. Let's talk about AI specifically. What's the sort of level of understanding maturity in the boardroom about AI?
Again, I would say it's increasing, but I think there's more questions about AI than there is this widespread understanding or acceptance or even agreement, consensus on how we're going to proceed with AI. I think it's exciting to a lot of board members that there are so many possibilities, that there are opportunities for growth. At the same time, there is this understanding that the guardrails aren't necessarily there. You know, anyone who's used one of the large language models, don't name any of them, I think there isn't a single person I've talked to who hasn't had a model hallucinate or give them a questionable answer to a query or to a task. And so there is this understanding that the technology is promising and that we should experiment with it and innovate with it within our enterprise. But there is this worry that it could be used for not so good purposes. Very recently, I spoke with a CISO where someone had written in the organization had received a voice message from someone purporting to be a very senior person, a board member, that they needed access to these systems. And the voice, the inflection, down to the expressions that they used were a dead ringer for this person. And so this person said, why would they be calling me? And at the same time, you know, we're all trained to be compliant. We're trained to be helpful, to be useful. But good for them, they also, they caught something that was interesting. They said, this person used the word, please send this to me. And they said, this person never says please. And so it was one of those things where, you know, the human, right, outsmarted the AI. And so they sent it to the CISO. They did, in fact, manage to find it was a deep fake. Mm-hmm. But this is one of those things where they impersonated this board member. They were able to take, you know, videos, right, and interviews this person had. They were featured on Bloomberg. And so they were able to just nail that voice. And so I think there's also been some board members who've been the subject of deep fakes. So there is this understanding that we have to be very cautious about it. At the same time, boards are also feeling like they don't want to miss out on this opportunity. They don't want their companies to miss out on this opportunity, you know, to do something really innovative. And so I would say there isn't a perfect pat answer that I can give you. There is this sense of, you know, it's exciting. They don't know enough about it to be safe around it. So there is this expectation that the CISO will be the person who's going to help navigate how to do this safely. At the same time, they don't want the CISO to be the hall monitor,
right,
saying no to it. In the Tesla, so there's something called ludicrous mode, right? That allows the car to go 200 miles an hour. And the only reason that exists is because there are really good brakes on that car. And so the CISO in many ways serves as the brakes for this next generation car. The CISO can allow or enable the organization to go really fast, to innovate, to try new things, largely because they've got the guardrails and the safety net to make sure that customers aren't harmed, that the reputation of the company isn't harmed, that employees remain safe. But they don't want the CISO to be the hall monitor.
I saw some statistics the other day that really did quite shock me. We had done a piece of work with Ipsos Mori on a survey around the world of the C-suite. And one of the findings that I did find so shocking around AI in particular was that it came back that the vast majority of organizations that we spoke to, whilst experimenting in some way, shape, or form with AI, also had absolutely no in place around AI. And that, to me, at best is negligent and clearly sits in the board's purview. I mean, that is what they are there to do. And I was surprised because I'd made this assumption that that was something that would have been covered off as part of the normal governance process. But is that something that you're seeing as well?
So we do see that, unfortunately, more often than is good. But I think there's also growing awareness. And so many boards, you know, particularly the audit committee and the committee, they are working very closely with a third-party auditor. They're working very closely with the CISOs, the CIOs, the chief legal officer, and the chief risk officer, but to really come together to create those policies. I would also say for organizations that have a chief data officer, there have been data governance in place for a lot of years. You know, even going back to, I would say, 2016, 2017, 2018, when we started to see the rise of the chief data and analytics officer, was that data governance was one of the things that they really had to tackle. Who had access to this data? Who could have access to the data? How are we going to acquire data? How are we going to ingest it, clean it? And then, like you said, you know, just even a code, a sense of how are we going to use this data? How are we going to use the data that we collect from our customers, from our partners, et cetera? And I would encourage that, you know, that's a really good place to start. AI governance will require a much more sophisticated, much more nuanced approach to governance. But for those companies that have already come together and articulated the data governance platform, that use that framework as a launching pad for that. And again, bring in the board. Really encourage them, you know, bring them into the conversation rather than just giving them a finished product. Make them part of the conversation.
Right. No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Final question for you. We talked about cyber, we've talked about AI. How do you see both of those things impacting the role of the board over the coming, say, 3 to 5 years?
Yeah. First of all, board members, the level of work required is already increasing. If you've ever seen a board briefing, it's several hundred pages, if not 1,000 pages long. And even though the board members themselves might meet at a certain set time per year, there are also executive sessions. There are a lot of things that they do outside of those defined pre-scheduled meetings. So one is I see board members getting more and more involved. They do reach out more and more to the operators to understand how AI is impacting the organization. I've also heard a lot of board members asking about our readiness. What is our readiness to do more with AI? And so it's really interesting that board members are also asking the human questions these days, and that it's not just about the governance, but they're also asking about what is the state of mind of the workforce? What's the cultural readiness and our learning agility to do more with AI? But it also means that, you know, along the lines of with cybersecurity, where they've had to educate themselves and find ways to learn more, I'm also seeing more and more board members take a lot of these certification courses or take these courses through universities, through the extension or the professional education, where they're learning more about AI on their own, just even reading up on this. But there is this understanding that there's going to be more asked of board members to know and to be aware. They're not going to sit down and say, how do you design a neural network? But they're going to understand what the applied implications are. What are the consequences if we don't get this right? But what are the incredible opportunities if we do get this right?
It's a fascinating time, isn't it? So much is changing. So much is really moving at pace, I think, and obviously presenting huge amounts of opportunities, not just at the individual level, but also at the corporate level. Karina, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing some of those views and insights that you've gained. Thanks very much indeed.
Steve, thanks so much. Take care.
Special thanks to this week's guest, Karina Mann. We'll be back next week with another new episode. In the meantime, if you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast. And we'd be pleased if you'd consider sharing the episode. To become an ISF member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.